I call the House Housing Finance and Policy Committee to order. Let it be known that we have a quorum established. So welcome everyone today. We have a full house for some exciting bills on the agenda. But before we get to the agenda, if I could have a motion for approval of the February 25th minutes.
So moved.
Representative Nash moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Once again, welcome everybody. I'm going to try to get us moving here quick. We have a lot of testifiers. Both bills today will be presented by me, so I'm going to hand off the gavel for the first bill to Vice Chair Dotseth, and I'll take the front.
Thank you, Chair Eagle. Our first bill on the agenda today is House File Number 2902, the State Housing Tax Credit. Chair Eagle, would like to make a motion to move this bill and refer it to the tax or to the Committee on Taxes. Chair Eagle is going to walk through the bill as we do see. However, that I have the A1 amendment in front of us today. Would you like to move your A1 amendment and get the bill in shape that you'd like to wish?
Yes, yeah, so Vice Chair Dotseth, I will make that motion. And yes, if we can move that amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like, that'd be great.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Chair Eagle, to your bill. Will you explain the bill and can you walk through it for the members for discussion?
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Dotseth. Was still getting all my paperwork together up here. You're pushing me. I like it. So the first bill in front of us today is House File 3902. This is going to be making adjustments to the State Housing Tax Credit. So many members of the committee and members of the public who are in this room today are very familiar with the effective use we've had of the State Housing Tax Credit. But as it's continued through its continued success, it's time for this committee and this legislature to start making the tweaks so it can continue to be more and more effective. One of the stats that I was told about this taxing issue was that in the last tax credit round, the portal had to be shut down in less than an hour because there are so many subscribers. So that shows that Minnesotans across the state, whether it's in the metro, whether it's in greater Minnesota, are looking to come into this tax credit and support and build their communities. So with the amended language that we've put on, we're making two things. So one of the adjustments that we're going to be making is working on repealing the sunset. So when this was first passed back in the day, there was a sunset put on this tax provision in a way to kind of see if it was working. Well, members, as you'll hear from the testimony that we have today, the program is working and is alive more than ever. So it's important that we start taking the first steps to remove that sunset so it can become part of our state tax policy. The other adjustment to it is going to be focusing on the income restrictions to the state and making sure that we are keeping this as a broad kind of perspective so that it works all around the state. So we don't see it going into one place or another. It's going to be spreading it out a little bit more. This bill was just heard in the Senate, so this amended language brings the bill up to snuff with what they passed in the Senate. And that's kind of the bill at hand. I'm happy to be carrying it. But with that, I want to get to testifiers so you can hear a little bit more about the good work it's doing around the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Chair Eagle. We'll move forward to testifiers. Please keep your comments to 2 minutes as we are on definitely a tight schedule today, folks. Courtney Schaaf.
Co-Chair Eagle, Co-Vice Chair Dotseth, and members of the committee, my name is Courtney Schaaf. I work as a policy manager for the Minnesota Housing Partnership. MHP drives innovative housing solutions through original research, expert community development and support, and advocacy for policies that ensure everyone has a place to call home. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3902. The State Housing Tax Credit has become, in a few short years, a tremendously successful program inspiring over 1,000 contributors and supporting close to 100 affordable housing projects across the state. Initiated by a large coalition of businesses, local governments, and housing leaders and developers across the state, the program was designed to be flexible and simple and to work in greater Minnesota as well as the metro area. MHP has been a proud champion of the program from inception to implementation, and we continue to facilitate its promotion. After oversubscribing in 2024 and 2025, we felt confident that we would see similar results for 2026, but as Co-Chair Eagle mentioned, that we were shocked by just how quickly this year The application opened at 8 a.m. on Tuesday, February 17th, just 2 weeks ago, and in less than 2 hours, Minnesota Housing received 418 contribution requests for over $15 million, well surpassing the $9.9 million credit cap. This oversubscription speaks to both the exploding need for affordable housing and for the effective design of this program, which incentivizes public-private partnerships to create more homes for Minnesotans. Thank you to Chair Igo for authoring House File 3902. MHP supports the alignment of the program with the Workforce Housing Program for maximum impact and establishing that geographic balance to ensure that Greater Minnesota and the metro area communities all have access to proportionate resources. We also strongly support the repeal of the program sunset so that the successful program can become a fixture housing development tool. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Testifier. We'll move forward to our second testifier today, which is Christine Insidney, President and Chief Executive Officer of Habitat for of Humanity. She's not here, so we'll just move. Why don't we move on to our third testifier? We actually have, which will be virtual, which is Nathan Thompson, Executive Director of North St. Louis County Habitat for, Courtney?
Kristen, sorry.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
We just got done with Courtney. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Igo, members of the committee, and thank you for your patience. It's very full in here, so I was watching from the screens out in the hall and noted my name. My name is Kristen Insidney, and I am the president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Minnesota, the statewide support organization for the 24 local Habitat affiliates working in 59 counties across the state. I'm here today in strong support of repealing the sunset for the state housing tax credit program, which has been a critical tool across the state, helping to finance affordable housing through taxpayer contributions. This year, we saw just how incredibly popular, and I think Courtney just mentioned, and essential this program is when it was oversubscribed in just under 2 hours. Since its inception, the state housing tax credit has been explicitly designed to finance housing that is affordable throughout the state of Minnesota, and this specific focus is exactly what's made it critical for our local communities. Right now, Habitat for Humanity is one of the very few builders addressing the shortage of starter homes across the state, particularly in Greater Minnesota, and so we see firsthand every single day that the gap in accessible, affordable homeownership is widening for working families. For Habitat offices across the state, this particular tax credit is so effective because it allows them to leverage what they already do best, and I think the next testifier is a Habitat executive director in Virginia, Minnesota, and so he'll share a little bit about the impact locally. But what we know is that in this last round, some preliminary numbers, the investments are going to impact over 24 projects in Greater Minnesota, ranging from Fergus Falls to Alexandria to St. Cloud to Virginia. Just all over the state. So this program really embodies what Habitat tries to do, bringing people together to build homes, community, and hope. And it's a really lovely way of providing an opportunity for individuals and businesses to engage in our work and housing comprehensively. And in particular with Habitat, allowing families of any means really to participate. You don't have to have a lot of wealth to engage in this program. And so we really think it's an opportunity to bring lots of folks to the table. So thank you for your leadership and thanks for the time.
Thank you, Kristen. We'll move to our third testifier, which will be a virtual, Nathan Thompson, Executive Director of North St. Louis County Habitat for Humanity.
Thank you, Chair Igo and members of the committee. Our affiliate serves the northern half of St. Louis County up here on the Iron Range. From Cotton to Ely, Hibbing to Hoyt Lakes, we've built homes in 15 of our Iron Range towns, serving 130 households with affordable home ownership since 1995. We're currently building 6 homes. The state housing tax credit has been an incredible tool for Greater Minnesota. It has helped us increase our capacity to build here on the Iron Range, and it has been used effectively by Minnesota Habitat for Humanity affiliates across the state. We're leveraging these funds to build homes with healthcare workers, gas station attendants, lumberyard workers, solar panel assemblers, and eye clinic technicians right here in our community. At Habitat, we gather people together to build homes. Typically, that's by swinging hammers. This tax credit allows us to talk to new donors who are thrilled to allocate their state tax dollars to build in their own communities. They become advocates of our mission to help us build more homes. We need to keep up the positive momentum we have built by removing the legislative sunset on the state housing tax credit program. Removing the sunset will ensure that local partnerships we're building today can be sustainable for years to come. The demand for this program is so intense that it became oversubscribed in 2 hours this year. We sent letters to 3,000 of our constituents and only 5 of them were able to contribute. It is essential that we add language ensuring geographical balance to the program. Minnesota Housing has prioritized geographical balance into other housing programs. We need to mirror that approach here. Adding this language will ensure that critical housing funds are guaranteed in rural regions like the Iron Range, who desperately need a fair opportunity to leverage these tax dollars. Thank you to Chair Igo for championing this legislation, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Nathan, for testifying today. We will move to our last testifier today, which is Mark Dorsett, Senior Director of Community Development and Corporate Facilities.
Good afternoon, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Dorsett, and I serve as the Senior Director of Community Development and Corporate Facilities at DigiKey at Three River Falls. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding amendments to House File 3902. DigiKey has been a proud contributor to the State Housing Tax Credit Program in both 2024 and in 2025. And over these 2 years, we've committed $3.5 million to help secure a 65-unit multifamily workforce housing development project in Thief River. This project and the economic growth and employment it will support would not have been possible without the Housing Tax Credit Contribution Program. And we were prepared to make an additional contribution in 2027 or beyond if we can find a developer to work with on that. The rapid subscription of this year's credits demonstrates the program's strong demand and effectiveness. And we believe that engaging private industry in this way is essential if we're going to meaningfully address Minnesota's housing shortage. Our most recent housing study shows a vacancy rate of just 0.3% in Thief River Falls. High inflation and elevated interest rates have created a difficult environment for housing development across all types and income levels. And at the same time, our county and neighboring counties are experiencing population decline. Without new housing to reverse that trend, we will struggle to maintain, level, and grow our workforce. At DigiKey, our business remains strong. We're the largest private employer in all-state Minnesota with 3,500 employees in Thief River Falls, about 5,000 globally. We grew 14% last year, and our sales are up 42% in the first 2 months of 2026. Today, our most urgent need is staffing. We currently are short about 165 employees in our order fulfillment center. And to support that hiring effort, we have taken several steps. We've increased our starting wage by $1 an hour. We've raised our sign-on bonus from $3,000 to $5,000. We've increased our relocation bonus from $5,000 to $7,500. And we've increased our referral bonuses by $500 as well.
Mr. Dorsett, we'll have to wrap it up here, please.
Yes. So these investments are necessary to attract employees in rural Minnesota, but they can only go so far without housing. So the proposed amendments removing the income restrictions and if they pair with the workforce housing fund, eliminating the 2028 sunset and ensuring the geographic balance will strengthen the program and help continue to deliver results. So we respectfully ask for your support for these amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Representative Igo for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsett. I will open up for a brief public discussion if anyone's got any comments from the public. Hearing none, I will actually a member discussion. Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Dotseth. Chair Igo, thanks for carrying this bill. As one of the original authors of this, it's been wonderful to see how each year it's picking up more attention and steam. And I've always thought it's just such a novel idea that allows Minnesotans all across the state to share in this win-win benefit of getting a tax credit to help build homes in communities in the ways they want to see. And as you mentioned, it's so overprescribed. The need for housing is so great. So this is just a common sense bill to move forward. And so thank you for carrying the bill. I encourage our members to support it as well.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Chair Igo renews his motion. Any final comments before?
No, thank you to the committee. Thank you to my testifiers. Always great to have a testifier from the range come down and support a bill, even if it is virtually. But this is a really good bill, right? And it's something that we can do to keep investing in public-private partnerships across the state of Minnesota. And that's what this bill is going to get at doing, so we can continue to diversify our opportunities to build more houses across the state of Minnesota and invest in our communities. So with that, I would like to renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Chair Igo renews his motion to re-refer as amended House File Number 2902 to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it, and the bill is on its way to taxes. Thank you, Chair Igo.
Next on our agenda is House File 3895, the Starter Home Act. And just a little table setting for the committee. This bill was technically re-referred to the Election and Government Operations Committee. So we'll be having an informational hearing on this bill. I'll remind committee members, we did hear a version of this bill and vote and send it out to Election and GovOps last year. But we look forward to a full and robust hearing today, and it's wonderful to see a packed house to talk about this important bill, and that has we've worked on together as co-chairs and with Representative Kraft as well. And so, and again, would note for members, there was a posted delete all amendment. That is the language folks should have in front of themselves. That's the bill we're going to be discussing here today. In front of us. And with that, I'll turn it to the author of the bill, Co-Chair Igo.
Thank you, Co-Chair Howard. And yeah, I'll just kind of, the front desk jumped the gun on us and sent this bill to GovOps. So here we are today doing an informational hearing. But all that included, we have a lot of good things to talk about today. And I want to highlight, you know, when you talk about this issue of land use and zoning, we always talk about how bipartisan it is. So for those in the room, but for those really watching and listening online, I just want to demonstrate really how committed we are to that. It's a Republican committee day in committee. I've handed the gavel to my Democrat co-chair, and I have my friend Representative Kraft sitting next to me because we want to present this bill in a way that this isn't a red or a blue issue. This is an issue for all Minnesotans. But to the bill that I want to start talking about, we've said it in this committee, but it's really important to say the American dream starts at home. And right now, Minnesota's facing an issue that many Minnesotans can't say they get a place to start at home. We are just shy of 100,000 housing units short in the state of Minnesota. And there's many factors that contribute to that. But the bill in front of us today with the Delete All Amendment is going to be taking that first step at making a difference in our housing supply. So some of the things that I wanted to boil down before I start breaking apart the bill and its subdivisions was, if you're here as a legislator to help cut red tape and relieve mandates that'll bring back personal freedoms and choice to find the homes you want, then this is a bill you want to support. If you want more diversity in housing, then this is a bill you should support. If you want more affordability in the state of Minnesota, then this is a bill you should support. And if most importantly, you want your districts to have stable communities, then this is a bill you should support. So getting to the bill at hand, I want to also talk about how we got here. Obviously, this bill has been being tossed around the Capitol and talked about now for almost 3 years. In the last 9 months, the members who have been working on this bill, the members here today, Representative Kraft, Representative Howard, I think we spent most of our interim in Zoom calls, whether it be with cities, whether it be with groups, whether it be with each other, trying to learn and dig in deep to get this bill right. So the rendition of this bill that's in front of members today and in front of the public today is a bill that's had dozens of iterations and lots of input put into it to get it where it's at. So we used not only our internal sources, our external sources in the state of Minnesota, but we also looked nationally. We looked to see what's going on in states like Florida. We looked to see what's going on in states like Colorado. We're looking at what's happening at Congress, It's worth mentioning that going on right now while we're having this discussion, the United States Senate, Senator Scott and Senator Warren, are working together on similar bills. This is not an issue that's just specific to Minnesota. It's a nationwide issue, and Minnesota needs to catch up and get on with the program that's going to invest in the most important part of what we call ourselves as Minnesotans and Americans, which is home. So going through the bill, I kind of want to do this in tandem with my friend Representative Kraft, because he was one of our folks that really helped us go through all the subdivisions, and we'll just kind of go off each other as we go through everything, because we really want to use this time today to explain each subdivision. So with that, I'll hand it off to Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be here. But before we dig into the sections, I do want to talk about why I'm here. And I want to explain why in my third session working on this bill, it's probably the bill I've put more work into and more time than any other. And everyone has different reasons to come to housing as an issue. It is the foundation of life success. It is so core. For me, it's kind of two key things. One is, as I've been out in my community doing a bunch of door knocking over the years, I can't tell you how often that I've heard the refrain that goes something like, I've lived in this house for 30 years, for 40 years, but I couldn't afford it today. Or my kids can't afford to live nearby here. Or I work here and I can't live here. So I'm very interested in what kind of systemic solutions we can do. But the other thing that brings me to this, which is different than I think some in the room, is climate change. And we have to build a lot of housing. Where we build it is really important. If we continue to build things further and further out and sprawl further and further out, it makes our transportation emissions and our transportation challenges a lot worse. Now, that may not be an issue that motivates all of you, but what it does mean is if we build it more intelligently, then we'll put less of a time tax on people's lives. We'll require them to spend less time in their cars, living the lives, getting to work, doing the things that they want to do. That's another way of saying that issue. I'll also say, you know, I've learned that there's no one magic bill that's going to answer or resolve the affordability crisis we're in housing. But one part of the answer is addressing housing supply and doing it in a systemic fashion. And that's what this, you know, the core part of this bill is about. It's about making it easier, faster, more predictable, and cheaper to build more types of housing in places that are closer to places that people work, go to school, and play. The housing availability and affordability problems we have are statewide problems. I am a former city council member. I don't put out a bill that touches on areas cities generally control lightly and without a lot of thought. There are many individual cities that are doing great and creative work in this area, but one or a few cities can't address the problems on their own. If one city is doing good work, but their neighbors aren't, that city's efforts will quickly be swamped by all the unmet demand out there. We need all cities across the state to do their part. At a high level, the bill has changed pretty dramatically since the first set of bills that were introduced in 2024. It's the result of extensive feedback from city groups, from planners, from advocates, as Chair Igo mentioned. And while we've been trying to do that all along, it really did go into higher gear since last session. And I would say at a high level, what we have here is a bill that's extremely focused on city choice versus being more prescriptive when we started out. It's bill language that we've been socializing for months versus just bringing it up in session. And we've spent a lot of time on thinking about implementation and really being pushed by city groups very hard to think about if this does pass, can it be implemented? And relying on existing city processes as much as possible. So that's that. With that, you want to go through the bill language?
Yeah, so for the members and for the public and those in the room, Mr. Chair, we're just going to kind of go through the subdivisions, and then I think if we could go to testimony and then answer member questions based on the subdivisions, I think makes the most sense. So for those following along and members of the committee, if we start with the DE1, you have your Section 1. That is mostly your definitions for the bill. I want to make sure we're very clear about what everything reads out for questions. When you get to lines 2.25, That's when you're going to start seeing the applicability, how this applies to greater Minnesota cities, metro cities, in what sections then it applies to. Subdivision 3 is your administrative approvals. So what that gets at is more of a streamlined plan to make sure that when people who are wanting to build homes or developers have streamlined plans for whether that be single-family homes or multifamily homes. Subdivision 4 is your residential design standards. For those in the committee and those in the public, that is your preemption on aesthetic mandates that has been being talked around this Capitol a long time, specifically championed by a member of this committee, Representative Nash. The next subdivision, 5, is going to be your a bill that was actually heard yesterday, which would be your preemption on HOAs demanded by cities. So we kind of got to this so that what we're seeing in some cities is that you are seeing HOAs be stood up to provide city-esque type services, increasing the cost of housing. So we are in negotiation and putting that in the bill. Subdivision 6 is your mixed housing and greenfield developments. So this is asking for 33% of greenfields to have mixed housing allotable in them. It also brings with it the minimum lot size of 1/8 acre, which is an important part of the legislation, but I'll get to kind of a compromise part in the bill when we get towards the end. Subdivision 7 is your ADUs, allowing for a minimum of 1 ADUs on lots, so we can help landowners and private property owners can look to expand housing in their communities. Subdivision 8 is the multifamily residential developments in commercial districts. So that sounds with it kind of scary, but I also want to mention that most cities in America were built with downtowns having their apartments and their first housing located right in their business districts. So the idea behind this is actually not new. It's looking back at how things worked in the past and bringing it back to the 21st century. Subdivision 9 is where a lot of our work was spent, and it was what we call the menu option. So inside the menu option, you will see that cities of the first, second, and third class have points that they need to reach through a list of menu options that have been provided. Any sort of good faith effort to, you know, get cities and the public to work together with developers and private property owners to select options that are proven to help build out more housing. So there's a lot of menu options there. I'm sure we'll hear about some in testimony, and happy to go over more of them with this committee after we get through testimony. We sort of wrap up towards the end of the bill where we get into public information, subdivision 10, which talks about how the menu options should be publicly listed on websites so that people know, developers know, what actions their municipalities and cities are taking to help incentivize housing in their communities. Subdivision 11, this is that section I mentioned earlier, talking about how we've reached compromise on a lot of things. We'll go back to like the 1/8 acre lot example in greenfields. For some cities, whether it be environmental, the ground doesn't support septic systems on 1/8 acre, or the city doesn't have the infrastructure capable of developing lots of that size, this subdivision 11 gives that freedom, that choice to cities to work with this new part of statute to make sure that they're not going to hurt their cities or put more costs on their constituents. So it's that way of making sure there's environmental but also infrastructure protections. And then finally, we get to the last couple subdivisions where we get to the interim ordinance prevention, so that before this is enacted, where there couldn't be new ordinances to try to stop its prevention, with a final effective date of January 1st of 2028. And members, that's the bill.
I could point out,
if Graf wants to add anything that I may have missed there in my brief overview.
No, didn't miss, but I want to point out a few things that are important. If you look at when we talked about subdivision 3, the administrative approach, this is an area when we started this process, we were pretty prescriptive in what we wanted to see. But what you see here is that these administrative approvals are meant to be leveraging existing city processes. So this is not, no need to create new processes. This is leveraging existing processes. In the selection of mixed housing districts and commercial districts, this is also, we're not specifying where these districts need to be. We're saying the cities can select where the increased density should go. We give some guidelines. We want to do it, make sure you're thinking about transit and commercial areas and schools, but the cities get to choose where the density goes. Big difference in prior approach. And then, let's see if there's one other thing I was going to mention. Oh, the infrastructure one. I think you mentioned it exactly perfectly, but I like to think of it as the don't build housing in stupid places item, right? That just says, look, if the infrastructure can't support it, if it's going to be an issue, then this is the clause that says we're not going to force things in just dumb places.
Thank you. Thank you both. We will move to testifiers, and I'll note that we have about 20 folks that have signed up, and so we'll stick closely to that 2 minute. And so if you hear hopefully a beep or you hear me kind of say finish your last sentence, we'll try to move through so that we have plenty of time for member discussion as well. First up, we're going to have Gabe Kravitz, manager of Housing Policy Institute with the Pew Charitable Trust, and after that, Paul Egger.
Thank you so much, Chair Igo, Chair Howard, and members of the committee for the opportunity to provide this testimony. My name is Gabe Kravitz from Pew's Housing Policy Initiative. Pew is a nonpartisan nonprofit organization based in D.C., and I'm a proud Minnesotan, so happy to be chatting with you all today. Our research found that Zillow data shows that median costs of housing in Minnesota to own has risen by 70% in the past decade. And the provisions included in the amendment that we're talking about today are similar to policies that have been undertaken in other jurisdictions, and they've proven really successful in increasing housing supply, lowering the costs, and also reducing homelessness. The effectiveness of these policies, the evidence for them is very strong. ADUs, accessory dwelling units, they rent for less, and they're a great way to add supply with limited, without government subsidy. Reducing minimum lot sizes, research has shown, has enabled the construction of 80,000 new starter homes in Houston and townhouses with prices that are typically affordable to those earning around the area median. Easing parking mandates and allowing more apartments, especially in commercial corridors, have helped keep rents nearly flat in Minneapolis from 2017 to 2022, even as rents rose statewide by 14%. And that saved folks in Minneapolis $1,700 over the course of a year. Our research shows that policies that enable housing and mixed-use buildings in commercial, which is considered under subdivision 8, are particularly effective because they speed up permitting. It basically is saying that if a three-story office building is allowed on a main road, then housing could be allowed there too. And that helps with walkability, reducing traffic and commuting costs. And when there's enough housing for residents in cities and towns, it also prevents sprawl and reduces miles driven, helping to protect productive agricultural land. So in light of these successful outcomes, 14 states so far have, including Montana, Texas, Washington, California, and Florida, have passed similar laws on a bipartisan basis, making it easier to build housing near jobs. And 18 states have passed laws to enable ADUs. So thank you so much for consideration, and happy to answer questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Paul Egger, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs with the Minnesota Realtors, and on deck, Daniel Lightfoot. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Paul Egger, Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We are a business trade association that has over 21,500 members working with buyers and sellers of all types of property statewide. Thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts on the DE amendment to the Minnesota Starter Homes Act. We believe strongly in the importance of home ownership and increasing opportunities for more Minnesotans to own their own home. Our 2026 session agenda includes support for actions that will improve housing affordability, placing emphasis on those that receive broad bipartisan support, promote increased housing supply, and provide flexibility for local units of government. We also share your goal of trying to remove barriers to building more market-rate housing to meet both current and future demand. Lack of adequate housing supply drives up prices and puts home ownership out of reach, particularly for first-time and first-generation home buyers. We also believe the best chance for enacting and implementing meaningful housing policy legislation that addresses supply and affordability is through consensus. We appreciate the work of all the bill authors, advocates, and local government representatives that led to the bill before the committee today. A menu or toolbox of options approach resonates with our members because it could increase supply while also providing cities with more flexibility in implementation. Subdivision 9 of the DE amendment is a version of a menu or toolbox approach. We think there is merit in trying to develop even stronger consensus on that type of approach as the bill moves forward, and we welcome the opportunity to work with the bill authors and other stakeholders as this legislation moves forward. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Daniel Lightfoot, Senior Intergovernmental Relations Representative for the League of Minnesota Cities, and on deck, Peter Butler, Council Member from Coon Rapids. Mr. Lightfoot, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. On behalf of our 842 member cities, the League of Minnesota Cities appreciates the opportunity to provide comments on House File 3895, the Starter Home Act. The A9 Delete Everything, as was referenced, amendment reflects more than 2 years of debate and negotiations between the League, bill authors, and other stakeholders. Now, to be clear, the League of Minnesota Cities opposes legislation that directly preempts city authority. While we cannot support those aspects of the bill, the League recognizes that the authors have addressed our implementation concerns by removing or modifying some of the most problematic provisions. The current language is a result of a robust, good faith policymaking process, and we believe the bill as written can be implemented. As the legislature considers this legislation, the League will continue to be available to provide feedback and input, but we are not actively seeking votes in support of or in opposition to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Peter Butler, council member, Coon Rapids, Minnesota. And after that, we have Nick Erickson, senior director of policy for Housing First. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, co-chairs Igo and Howard, along with the rest of the committee for having me here today. My name is Peter Butler, and I'm a current council member with Coon Rapids City Council. Like many city councils, we don't all agree on what the solution is for housing, but I'm here to express my views in support of the Starter Homes Act. When I campaigned in 2024, housing came up every day. It was people asking, where am I going to live? It was families talking about, how could I pay rent or afford a home? It was seniors looking, where would they live when stairs or other features of their houses became difficult for them? I would have people tell me they didn't know where their kids and grandkids would live, and chills would go down my spine when people would say, Pete, where am I going to live? My wife and I experienced similar conversations when we bought our first home in 2022. We bought an Orrin Thompson Rambler, which is a 1950s house, which at the time sold for about $13,000. If you were to take that for inflation-adjusted dollars, it'd be around $150,000 today. We paid $285,000, and a lot of these houses go for $300,000 today. This means that a starter home in Coon Rapids, which bluntly is cheaper than a lot of the metro area, is still soaring to $300,000 or above. Even if you're paying 20% down and you're looking at the insurance, the mortgage, the taxes, you're still looking at probably a monthly payment of $2,000 or more. And there's even apartments in Coon Rapids that cost $2,000 or more. Coon Rapids, not California, not New York City. You know, my house is turning 70 this year, and I'm thinking a lot about how housing markets have changed. I'm thinking about how it would probably be illegal for Mr. Thompson to build his famous Rambler today. There's a lot of reasons why costs go up, but I do think zoning's a portion of it. I'm so appreciative of what this committee has done, not just this year, but over previous years to try to address this issue, because we do have a housing crisis. But the current system is too disjointed and costly. I've seen single-family home developments only get approval if we add a homeowners association, which burdens costs for new residents. I've seen skepticism to outright apartments, and I've even seen uneasiness with additional senior housing. Whether you have your first home, it's your last home, or something else, I want everyone to have the dignity of the American dream. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Next, Nick Erickson, Senior Director of Policy, Housing First, Minnesota. And on deck, virtually, we'll have Travis Flynn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Always a pleasure to be in the Housing Committee. My name is Nick Erickson, Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota, where our mission is homeownership opportunities for all Minnesotans, and that's why we're here today, is to support this bill. Since 2021, housing permits statewide have fallen 38.5% to near-decade lows. We also saw in 2024 the largest single-year decline in homeownership in Minnesota in four decades. Just let that sink in. because that's the cost of inaction on housing reform. This discussion in Minnesota goes back nearly a decade. In one of the earliest conversations the legislature had, a home builder member of ours warned a committee that you have months, not years, to act. But since then, our housing shortage has doubled, construction has now slowed to our post-recession recovery pace, and our current pace, our housing shortage now represents 5 years of home building above and beyond what it takes just to tread water in this state. Simply, the current system is not working, and inaction on proven reforms is only harming Minnesotans. When we don't build enough homes, opportunities leave the state. That's why the U.S. Chamber estimates that 63,000 jobs have not been created in Minnesota because of the housing shortage. That brings with it $9 billion in lost economic output for this state. That's why we're at a crossroads. Inaction or watering down these bills does not protect Minnesotans. All it does is sideline our state. So I ask you, how much worse will this problem grow before the state acts? As you heard from our presenters, this bill is a result of 9 months of hard work and compromise. It reflects the best of Minnesota. It is leaders working across political and geographic differences to come together and improve the lives of Minnesotans they serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Drynell Foster, Chief Impact Officer, Groundbreak Coalition.
Oh.
And Travis, we got you next.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Drynell Foster. I'm the Chief Impact Officer at the Groundbreak Coalition, and I'm here today in strong support of the Starter Home Act. The Groundbreak Coalition includes over 40 philanthropic, private, and civic organizations that are pulling expertise and capital to support generational wealth building in Minnesota through home, through business, and property ownership. As members of this committee know, a home is more than a place to live. It is an investment in stability and community and wealth for the next generation. Through deep collaboration, Groundbreak is mobilizing capital for 11,000 new homeowners over the next decade, providing up to $50,000 per household in down payment assistance, paired with loans from the network of lending partners. Our goal is to make ownership possible at scale for communities who have been excluded from wealth building for generations. Many factors, including restrictive zoning rules, have contributed to the home ownership and wealth gap that we see today. Without policy change, efforts to expand home ownership will be stifled. Competition for the existing stock of starter homes is driving up pricing. Low vacancy rates are raising rental costs and are making it harder for families to save for a home. The Starter Home Act helps address Minnesota's housing shortage and responds to the needs of many first-time homeowners who are looking to buy smaller single-family homes, duplexes, townhomes that are much more affordable. While zoning laws have historically been used to exclude people, this does not need to be our future. We all benefit when Minnesotans have stable housing and generational wealth that comes from owning a home. A recent social return on investment study found that every dollar in Groundbreak's home ownership initiative returns $5.25. Each household with low wealth that is able to own a home in Minnesota gains $132,000 in lifetime benefits from higher incomes, children's educational gains, and better health. We urge state leaders to pass the Starter Home Act and ensure more Minnesotans have the opportunity to live, to thrive, and afford the places where they want to live. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Travis Flynn and on deck, Susan Arnes. I think both of those are virtual.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your time, Chair Igo and committee. My name is Travis Flynn, and I've worked in the public health field as a peer recovery specialist for the better part of the last 5 years here in Minnesota. I'm a father of an 8-year-old daughter and a 4-month-old son. I do my best to serve my community every day, but can't afford to live in the community I serve. As a lifelong Iron Ranger who currently resides in District 7, that is discouraging. The average first-time home buyer is 40 years old, which means I'm about 3 years short of having the means of affordability saved up. having a stable home is a foundation that will help not only my family, but many others to be able to prosper. We need state lawmakers to step in and ensure that local policies don't unintentionally shut out first-time home buyers. More housing supply and fewer unnecessary mandates with lower costs across the board. Home ownership should not be out of reach for people who work hard and contribute to their communities. Please take action and cut the red tape that is pricing us out. Sincerely, Travis Flynn and family. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Susan Arnst, Mankato City Manager, and on deck, Bradley Peterson. Ms. Arnst, welcome.
Thank you, chairs and member of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. Housing is a top priority for the city of Mankato, and we have backed that up with our words and actions. Over the past 2 years, we've made meaningful zoning and land use changes to support development. We've reduced parking requirements for multifamily housing. We've allowed apartments in commercial and highway business districts and have approved a variance in a shoreland district to increase density with concurrence from the DNR. We also have made significant financial investments in our community, supporting a community land trust, a housing trust fund, and in the last 2 years, we've invested more than $2.5 million in single-family ownership opportunities in our community. And at the end of this month, we'll break ground on a 40-unit supportive housing project in our community. As to this bill, we do support the language that's in subdivisions 4 and 5. We don't regulate those areas. We do have concerns with some of the provisions in subdivision 6. It requires us to update our land use and zoning code. The cost to update these plans are significant and unfunded, which will require them to be budgeted for in 2027 and paid for by taxpayers. While I appreciate the language in subdivision 11 that I believe I heard earlier suggests that we wouldn't build in areas that we shouldn't build, we do have to update our plans so that we know whether or not we can even do that work in the greenfield areas. We do have some questions about some of the language in provision 6A that we'll address directly with the chairs about some inconsistency, where it talks about 33% of the buildable area in the community, and yet the provision is really intended to be for greenfield development. So we want to have a conversation about potentially some of the inconsistency that is shown there. And last, we can question whether or not the ADU provisions will really meaningfully improve affordability. ADUs that are attached to a unit function like a duplex, and those can work in areas, and we already allow them. Detached ADUs often require separate utility connections, driveways, other things that increase construction costs and potentially limit affordability gains. Mankato is committed to increasing our housing supply, but a one-size-fits-all approach does not necessarily reflect the local conditions here. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next, we have Bradley Peterson, Executive Director of Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and after that, Brian Baer, City Administrator with City of Hugo. Mr. Peterson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Bradley Peterson with Flaherty and Hood here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. First, I do want to acknowledge the many changes to this bill. Nonetheless, CGMC remains opposed to the policy approach in this bill for a number of reasons. I first want to draw your attention to the packet that was provided to the committee that outlines a number of stories from our cities. These stories are examples of what cities are already doing, many of the things that Ms. Arntz just spoke of, as well as the ongoing challenges they face. As you can see, cities are already upzoning residential districts, creating areas with smaller lot sizes, facilitating multifamily in commercial zones, allowing for ADUs, and eliminating or reducing parking requirements. All things that appear to be in the spirit of what advocates of this bill would have cities do. These efforts, as Ms. Arntz noted, require significant staff time and expense and often necessitates the need to hire outside consultants. As cities look at the requirements and choices presented in this legislation, few, if any, would be able to currently meet the standards in this bill. That means that cities who have already done this work and spent significant time and money would have to revisit their efforts. This essentially is an unfunded mandate on those communities. and we're further concerned that this unfunded mandate will not result in more housing. The greatest housing challenges facing Greater Minnesota is not zoning and land use controls. It is lack of developers, a lack of workforce, high infrastructure costs, and high labor and material costs. Finally, I do want to note that there are a few items in this bill that we were close to an agreement on language last year and that I believe could be resolved with little effort, those being the residential design standards and HOA provisions. In conclusion, we've been at this for several years. I do, however, believe that we may be able to put this issue to bed, assuming the continued willingness of the legislature to engage on strategies that lean into additional flexibility on the part of cities in terms of how to meet the underlying objectives of this bill. And we are committed to working with the chairs and members of this committee to get there.
Thank you. Next up, Brian Baer, City Administrator with the City of Hugo, and after that, Mayor Jim Hovland, City of Edina. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, chairs, members. My name is Brian Baer. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Hugo. I'm testifying on House File 3895 as amended today on behalf of Metro Cities. I'd like to thank the authors of the bill for their continued willingness to listen to concerns raised by cities and for incorporating some of our feedback. There are some areas of the bill for which we believe there is common ground, and we look forward to further discussion on those areas. However, we continue to respectfully oppose the substantially preemptive provisions in the bill. Now, Hugo is a northeast suburb that is growing steadily with a population over 17,000. We have a history of flexibility in our city for housing development, including allowing mixed-use land areas of up to 60 units per acre and lots as narrow as 40 feet. We also have areas guided as medium density residential from 3 to 8 units per acre in places that make sense for our city. And we allow for twin homes and ADUs in single family districts. However, these kinds of projects are not being capitalized on or proposed by developers. Instead, they want to do single family projects in Hugo, and some developers, they're converting twin home lots that are already approved to detached single family lots. We found that although the city has approved very small lots, it does not make homes more affordable. The bottom line is Hugo has not been approached by developers who want to build smaller, more affordable homes. Despite the city's flexible policies, what we get are huge homes on tiny lots. We recently applied for and received a policy development grant from the Met Council to further analyze our regulations and support us in reducing barriers. This grant has supported our work in incentivizing more missing middle projects, including allowing them by right in commercial districts, but only where it's appropriate. We're concerned that the bill blankets density through rigid percentages and erodes local decision-making and the public voice by shifting that decision-making process away from the community and to for-profit builders and developers. Local governance ensures that residents have a direct seat at the table for developments that shape their neighborhoods. Thanks to both of the chairs and members for your time today. We look forward to continuing to work with the committee on addressing housing needs in our communities.
Thank you. Next, we have Mayor Jim Hovland with the City of Edina, and on deck, Rihanna Lee. Mayor, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair Howard. Chair Eagle, nice to meet you. Representative Kraft, these are my two neighbors to the east and the north, and we're pretty close, and they've been unbelievable in terms of talking about this issue over the last 9 months, as Representative Eagle indicated. Actually, for the past couple of years, the interaction's been great. In fact, it reminded me of the relationship we have with these two. Reminded me of that commercial I see on TV once in a while about the heating and air conditioning people. We love these guys. And that's the way we feel about them. But like any relationship, sometimes you don't agree on everything, and that's the situation here. First of all, I would tell you that I represent the not only the City of Edina, but I'm the chair of the Municipal Legislative Commission, which is 19 cities across the metropolitan area. And our cities are building housing. Our 19 member cities have increased housing stock over the past 10 years by... We've done this through locally led planning, targeted incentives, and flexible funding to encourage development and increase housing supply. And while you heard me say a moment ago we had some general reservations about parts of the bill, let me be clear that we come before you not as obstructionists, not as defenders of the status quo, and certainly not as adversaries of housing production. We come as partners in a cause we share to ensure that people of our state our teachers, our tradespeople, our nurses, new graduates, our seniors and young families can find a place to call home. We acknowledge this plainly, that Minnesota needs more housing. We need more supply. We need more affordability. We need more options in every community, urban, suburban, and rural alike. On this, there is no quarrel. But there is a legitimate question, indeed a profound one, and that is, how do we get there? The proposal before you would mandate that cities designate 33% of their greenfield mass for mixed-use housing, require multifamily residential and commercial and industrial districts, and remove discretionary review for certain developments. It is bold. It is sweeping. It is statewide in scope for cities above 2,500 in the metro area and above 5,000 in greater Minnesota. And yet we must ask, does boldness alone guarantee wisdom? Cities do not resist housing. Cities build housing. Cities zone land, extend infrastructure, issue permits, negotiate development agreements, invest in affordable units, and work daily, often painfully, with residents and developers alike to bring projects from vision to reality. Cities are where housing actually happens. What we resist is not production, but we do resist preemption. Local government is not an obstacle to democracy. It is democracy in its most immediate and tangible form. It is where residents speak face-to-face, where trade-offs are weighed in the open, where land use decisions are made with intimate knowledge of roads, sewers, schools, transit, and neighborhoods. To sweep aside that local knowledge with a uniform statewide mandate is a mistake, is to mistake uniformity for progress. Housing markets are not uniform. Infrastructure capacity is not uniform. Community character is not uniform, nor are economic conditions. A requirement that 33% of land of mixed use may therefore be transformative in one community and deeply destabilizing in another. Mandating multifamily residential and industrial districts may create opportunity in some places and conflict with job preservation or environmental constraints in others. Administrative approval, while appropriate in many contexts, may also eliminate the very public processes that build durable community support. If we seek production, let us not produce resentment. If we seek affordability, let us not create backlash. Durable reform must be rooted in legitimacy. And so we offer a different path based on partnership. First, allow cities to meet state housing goals through performance, not prescription. Set clear, measurable production and affordability targets. Hold cities accountable for outcomes, but allow flexibility in how those outcomes are achieved. Let innovation flourish rather than conformity prevail. Second, align mandates with resources. Housing does not materialize by zoning alone, as my colleague from Hugo said. It requires infrastructure investment, gap financing, tax policy tools, and regulatory alignment. If the state desires greater density, then let the state also strengthen tools such as tax increment financing, infrastructure grants, and affordable housing funds. Production follows feasibility. Third, reward reform. Provide incentives for cities that adopt pro-housing policies, streamlined approvals, upzoning near transit, reducing parking minimums, accessory dwelling unit allowances, adaptive reuse of commercial property. Many cities are already ensuring and pursuing these reforms. Encourage them to expand them. Share best practices. Build momentum rather than resistance.
Mayor, if I could ask you to...
Thank you.
Yep.
Yes, thank you for that. So remember, there's a committee...
As friends often do, you know.
Yeah, very good. All right. No wrap up.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
No, you. You can finish your thought, Mayor, if you have.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, Rayanna Lee, Legislative and Coalitions Director with Minnesota Americans for Prosperity. And on deck is Julia Capinelli, Social Worker with Eden Prairie Public Schools. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. My name, for the record, is Rayanna Lee. I'm the Legislative and Coalitions Director for the Americans for Prosperity chapter here in Minnesota. You have heard a lot of numbers, and I am not going to repeat them. They are also in my letter and materials. But what I want to underline right now is that AFP takes the issue of affordability incredibly seriously. And we took this issue over the last two years. We knocked over 500,000 doors. In 2025, we took the question of the Minnesota Starter Home Act to your constituents, and over two-thirds supported that. Your constituents, the people of Minnesota, are saying that something needs to be done. The next largest group of the people that we spoke to said, listen, I don't know enough to commit to an actual yes, but I like what you're saying. And again, we are talking to your constituents, not local governments, not special interest groups. And the stories are consistent that we heard at the doors I spoke with a mom who was like, listen, I love my daughter. I want her to move out. She wants to move out, but she cannot afford it. We also heard from a couple who, one of their aging parents, they were looking to build an ADU on their property, and they were roadblocked by the local government. And I can't tell you how many young couples that we spoke to that are essentially giving up on the idea of owning a house right now and buying their first home together, because it is just straight up unaffordable. And members, I think it's really important to put this into perspective that we are approaching 250 years since the Declaration affirmed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I want to remind you that property rights and home ownership have been central to the American dream. And the excessive regulations that we are seeing, that continues to put the American dream out of reach for far too many. The status quo is not working. The hostile environment that is preventing the market from building what your constituents want runs contrary to the founding principles of our country. Across districts and demographics, people are telling us the same things, that they want homes. So I will just end with, when we return to your districts, we will be talking about what happened here at the legislature as accountability. And it'll be up to you to let us know, are we going to tell your constituents that you took bold action to make housing more affordable and attainable, or are you going to uphold the status quo? Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Julia Capinelli, social worker with Eden Prairie Public Schools. And after that, virtually, Tobias Peter. Maybe they're both virtual. Julie, I don't see Julie, so we'll go to Tobias Peter.
Thank you, co-chairs Igo and Howard and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of the Minnesota Starter Home Act. My name is Tobias Peter. I'm the co-director of the AEI Housing Center, a nonpartisan, nonprofit public policy organization in DC. I previously lived for several years in both St. Cloud and Duluth. Minnesota has not built enough homes to meet demand. Targeted reforms like these in this bill, if implemented largely by right, by our analysis, can enable around 10,000 new homes per year, lowering price pressure and strengthening the state's economy. But that's not all. The bill limits minimum lot sizes in new subdivisions and allows more housing options on many existing lots, making it possible to build smaller, more affordable starter homes. When smaller lots are allowed, our research shows that builders produce more homes at 15 to 20% lower price points, all without subsidies. Second, the bill allows homes near jobs and shopping. Minnesota has vast amounts of underused commercial land. Allowing housing in commercial areas helps workers live closer to their jobs and takes better advantage of existing infrastructure. The bill also reduces unnecessary design mandates and procedural barriers that add cost without improving safety. These are practical, bipartisan ideas that expand access, respect property rights, reduce sprawl, and support employers. One point is especially important. To meaningfully increase supply, reforms should be clear, by right, and able and apply citywide, leaving little room for workarounds for cities. At the same time, the state shouldn't micromanage outcomes. The market will build more starter homes if given the opportunity, and this bill is a great start. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Benjamin Olson, principal with City Desk Studios, and on deck, Anna Nelson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Benjamin Olson. I'm a principal at City Desk Studio and an architect by training. For the past decade, I've led efforts to design and build attainable housing projects in Greater Minnesota in partnership with a variety of nonprofit, municipal, and private development partners. Our work has won AIA Minnesota's Affordable Housing Design Award and an AIA Minnesota Commendation in Design for Economy. I also teach a course at the University of Minnesota College of Design called The American Starter Home that chronicles the emergence and disappearance of this housing type from America's built environment. Since 2020, I've designed 35 units of attainable housing that were built. This is certainly cause for celebration, as every unit built in this sector is a win. Many of these units were allowed by zoning changes, such as Duluth's abolition of building and lot width minimums and St. Paul's 1-4 unit development reforms. But in that same period, I've designed 71 units of missing middle housing that were not built. I'm here to report that our housing shortage persists not for lack of trying. Housing projects are denied by obstacles to development, local controls that favor stasis over change, and a chronic failure of imagination that the problem can be solved. When a housing development project is denied at a planning commission or city council hearing, people think it just goes away, but it doesn't. The sunk cost of a project withered on the vine is passed on to the developer's next project in the form of higher rents, premium sale prices, slashed fees for professionals, or bottom dollar construction costs. I'll describe just one project that typifies the challenges of building townhomes where they are not allowed by right. The city of Grand Marais in Minnesota's Arrowhead region has a housing shortage tallied at 600 units. The Planning Commission refashioned the city's zoning ordinances to promote housing development, but left townhomes as conditional rather than permitted use. In 2024, I was hired to design a planned unit development that included 21 townhouses and 8 ADUs on a large downtown parcel. That parcel was already platted for 29 single-family homes, which is the same density we proposed. We designated 5 units as workforce housing and secured financing from MHFA, the local HRA, and the IRRRB that made home ownership available to folks living and working in Grand Marais. Following a contentious public hearing, the project was unanimously approved by the Planning Commission, only to be denied by City Council. We resubmitted a project with reduced density, and again were granted unanimous approval from Planning and denial from City Council. Bjorkberg Grand Marais would have been a $10 million tax-based development project. It would have provided 21 new units of home ownership and 8 rentals in a community that had issued just 1 building permit the year it was proposed. But it faltered at the last hurdle because townhomes are subject to conditional use approvals rather than allowed by right in Grand Marais. Thank you, committee, and I'd be happy to share more about this important bill as it's crafted and workshopped.
Thank you. Next, we have Anna Nelson with Neighbors for More Neighbors, and after that, Connor Carroll. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Anna Nelson, and I'm a volunteer with Neighbors for More Neighbors, and I'm here in support of the Starter Homes Act. My husband grew up in Le Sueur near Mankato, and he spent his childhood riding his bike to school, to his friends, and to the store to buy treats. When we looked for our own home, that's the kind of walkable community that we wanted, where our kids could have a little more freedom and we could walk to the grocery store. However, our jobs are in the Twin Cities, and we learned pretty quickly that walkable neighborhoods are really hard to find here. They're often highly sought after and very expensive. We're lucky we could afford to buy our home in a community like this. I live in a rare missing middle development, a townhouse. What I have is special. My townhouse neighbors look out for each other. We don't just share walls, we share meals. We share babysitters. We share driveway chats. Homes like mine, where shoveling and yard work and roof repair are handled by the community, are easier on people who are getting older, and also those of us who work a lot and have busy children. I run into my neighbors on foot all the time, at the playground, at the bus stop, or at the many local businesses that we can walk to around the corner. When so many people live close together, it's easier for nearby businesses to make it. They have a built-in customer base right there. Our neighborhood businesses recognize us. Too many municipal governments have made it impossible to create neighborhoods like mine. Local laws that block what we have don't make sense for our communities. I love my neighborhood, and I wish it was easier to build more homes like ours, because I want more Minnesotans to have the kind of community that I'm lucky to live in.
Thank you. Next, we have Connor Carroll with Neighbors for More Neighbors, and on deck, Wanda Schroeder, Executive Director for Central Minnesota Builders. Mr. Carroll, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Connor Carroll. I live in Minneapolis, and I'm a volunteer and board member with Neighbors for More Neighbors. I'm here today to speak in favor, in support of House File 3895. I grew up in Rosemount, and after college, I lived with my parents for 2 years while I made payments on some of my student loans and began to save up for a house in the neighborhood I grew up in. However, I quickly found out most of the homes in Rosemount are big houses with large yards, 2 and 3 car garages, much more space than I actually need. And these available homes were and are way outside my price range. Smaller homes, duplexes and fourplexes, were almost non-existent. Rental apartments in town were also unaffordable for me. In 2015, I ended up moving to Minneapolis because two friends offered to rent me their extra bedroom for $400 a month, which I could not find any deal like that in my hometown. And I've lived in Minneapolis ever since. And over the past 10 years, I feel like I've really found my community and I'm here to stay. But sometimes I wonder what my life would have been like if I had stayed, if I had actually been able to afford a starter home in the neighborhood I grew up in. And the life I built for myself in Minneapolis, I could have built that in Rosemount instead. My sister, her husband, and their two children could have afforded a home in town instead of buying one in the northeast suburbs. I could have helped more easily with childcare for them. My parents are close to retirement, and living closer would make it easier to help them when they need it. But because of the distance, it's surprisingly difficult to coordinate all of our schedules with them and my other sister because of the various car trips that have to be planned and made. When I grew up, my grandma's house was a block from where I lived. My aunt and my cousins lived 2 blocks away. And we could just walk over whenever we wanted to, drop in. And that kind of upbringing, which was really fun for me and easy to do, has just not been available for the next generation of my family. Unfortunately, city-level efforts have not been enough to fix this problem statewide. Some cities are committed to building the affordable homes that are needed, but others are at best uninterested, and the results are uneven affordability across the state in communities which are out of reach for the people who want to live and work there. The Starter Homes Act would give families a chance to live closer to one another and maintain strong bonds. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Wanda Schroeder, Executive Director for Central Minnesota Builders Association, and next is on, is Ann Mavity. Ms. Schroeder, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Wanda Schroeder. I'm the Executive Director of the Central Minnesota Builders Association, where we represent nearly 300 builders, developers, contractors, and affiliates in Greater St. Cloud in Central Minnesota. For years, we have heard the increasing alarm from area community and business leaders that we are falling far behind in creating enough new housing to meet area needs and falling behind in affordability. We are literally tens of thousands of units and several years behind just in our area. We cannot address the housing shortage without building more homes. Our state's housing deficit has doubled since 2018. Housing permits have plummeted and are below 2018 levels. We are the highest cost state in the region for new and existing housing. This has to stop. Policymakers have to stop adding to the problem by piling on more and more costly regulations and mandates. Research shows that in Greater St. Cloud area, we lack readily available starter home opportunities. We need to put housing needs of Minnesotans above political needs of government. Continuing on this path is unsustainable and will not solve this crisis. As has been noted in past versions of legislation, this bill is not a fix-all for housing affordability, but it is a solid and important start. We cannot address the state's housing challenges if we don't get land use right. These zoning reforms are critical to solving our housing crisis. Thank you for your time, and we support and hope you support this bill.
Thank you. Next is Ann Mavity with Minnesota Housing Partnership. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Chair Igo, and members of the committee. My name is Ann Mavity. Thank you for having me back and the opportunity to testify in support of the Starter Home Act. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership and co-chair of the Yes to Homes Coalition that's been working on this bill. And I just want to take a moment to acknowledge, in my decades of experience of working on housing, the stakeholders and bipartisan nature of this particular piece of legislation is something I've never experienced and I'm very appreciative of across the housing continuum and beyond working on this. So this is the third year that this committee has considered the legislation, and throughout this time, coalition partners, city representatives, legislators on this committee and beyond have learned and listened to each other and done the really hard work to ensure that these interests and concerns are understood and reflected in this legislation that you're seeing today. This bill is not the bill that we envisioned 3 years ago, but it is better. it is reflective of the range of all of these interests and has been informed by these conversations. So I just want to highlight a couple things. One is what's been really important that's reflected in this bill is that we can create new homes and housing choices in places where cities choose and that makes the most sense. So cities get to choose a modest amount of residentially zoned districts and commercially zoned districts where more housing types and densities are allowed. And once cities have determined where housing is allowed, then the city gets to use their own administrative processes to streamline and increase efficiency to get those approvals. Finally, the cities that are already leading in creating homes, many of whom we've heard from, they get credit for those actions and those strategies that they've already adopted. So we're acknowledging that. So this legislation reflects the hard reality that the current policies and processes are not working. They're not producing housing outcomes. So this legislation is a necessary tool for our state to address our unbalanced housing supply challenge, but it is not a panacea for all of our housing challenges. Next year, this year and next year and beyond, we'll continue to have conversations with the committee on ensuring that we have sufficient resources to address the affordability gap for our lowest income neighbors. And those investments are also needed, but without housing supply, those investments will not have the impact that they need. So as a former three-term city council member, I served three terms in St. Louis Park and serving on the board of Metro Cities and the board of the League of Minnesota Cities, I understand the enormous complexities of balancing these diverse city interests from across the state with that widespread demand you're hearing about for more housing in every corner of the state. This bill accomplishes that. Thank you.
Thank you. And then last we have Kathy Capone Bennett with Twin City Housing Alliance. Welcome to the committee.
Save the best for last.
That's right.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Bennett. I'm the executive director of the Twin Cities Housing Alliance. We represent more than 100 housing providers across the Twin Cities. Our mission is simple: build more homes to increase affordability for all. We support the Minnesota Starter Home Act because it addresses barriers that will increase our ability to build additional multifamily rental housing that Minnesotans need. Housing providers have experienced rising costs and opposition to higher densities, resulting in housing permits to fall in the Twin Cities sharply since 2022 and continue to drop since then and has stalled in 2026. That means fewer homes in the pipeline at the exact moment demand continues to grow and affordability continues to rise. The shortage has real consequences: higher prices, fewer options for families, and increased pressure on communities trying to attract and retain workers. To close this gap, we need an all-hands-on-deck approach that removes unnecessary obstacles to housing production while maintaining strong building standards and local authority. The Minnesota Starters Home Act is a practical, targeted step in that right direction with no direct fiscal impact to the state. However, there is a fiscal impact when more homes are not built. By streamlining the approval process and allowing multifamily housing in more commercially zoned areas, the bill reduces lengthy and unpredictable rezoning processes that often delay or derail projects. These reforms create more predictability, lower costs, and open the door to new housing in places where infrastructure already exists. This legislation strikes the right balance. It preserves community engagement. It preserves the ability to partner with cities while ensuring that needed housing isn't stalled by avoidable delays. It expands opportunities for homes in appropriate locations and helps restore the level of housing production Minnesota needs to remain affordable and economically strong. We urge the committee to advance the Minnesota Starter Act, and we look forward to working together to address Minnesota housing shortage in the future.
Thank you. Members, that concludes the testimony for folks that have signed up to testify, and would invite some member discussion on the bill. And I want to thank all the members of the public and those that came. It's always great when we can have robust testimony, and we really heard from folks all across the state. First, we have Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you so much, Chair Howard and Chair Igo. Thank you, Representative Kraft. I want to just speak in strong support of the Starter Homes Act. I was on the Coon Rapids City Council for 4 years before being a representative, and I watched development after development proposal get voted down by the majority on my council. One example that's striking, but one of many, we had a strip mall, mostly empty, in need of much maintenance and repair, sitting there. We had a developer come and propose to have an apartment building surrounded by townhomes with a small retail center on the corner. Would have been perfect for this location. Voted down by the council. And that is just one example of many. It happened over and over in my 4 years. We know the average age to buy a home is 40 years old in Minnesota today. From my high school economics class, I know that when demand is greater than supply, it drives up costs. So we have heard about this shortage also from multiple different groups. We heard about it from Commissioner Ho of Minnesota Housing. We've heard about it from the Realtors Association. We've heard about it from MHP. It exists. You've heard from some of the cities who testified today claiming they are building homes. I believe you. But they're claiming they're building it and it's okay and there isn't a problem. That isn't true. Governor Dayton had a task force on housing in 2017. That's almost 10 years ago to address critical statewide shortage of housing. Since then, it's only gotten much, much worse. What we are doing is not working. As legislators, it is our jobs to change local zoning that is crippling the development of all types of housing. And it is our job to make sure regular folks can achieve the American dream, that if you work hard, you can afford a home and you can afford to take care of your family. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Scraba.
That was awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Accessory dwelling units, talked about required municipality to allow at least one. As being the chair of St. Louis County Planning for over 12 years, one of the issues that we always had with accessory dwelling units is when you're by a lake. Is this still going to allow, even though the code may not, does this supersede the code for accessory dwelling units by the lake?
Co-Chair Igo.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba. So if you're looking at Subdivision 7 on ADUs, that is what Subdivision 11 on infrastructure is all about. That's where the environmental would kick in. So, yes, that would make sure that you couldn't supersede riparian rights on lakeshore to build ADUs or, like, boathouses if we're talking about your district.
That's where I was going, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scraba, yeah.
Anyone that has a boathouse always tries to put a livable unit above the boathouse. Any way they can weasel it in, they will. So I just wanted to make sure that was still covered.
Yeah, we don't deal with that in Richfield, Representative Scraba.
My district, it is prevalent. I did receive some letters from zoning people in our communities. They're all smaller, so they're all exempt, but they felt like they needed to say, you know, I'm not sure I want to support this. Is this the right thing to do? The city of Two Harbors basically abandoned their zoning, planning and zoning to allow on a city lot, if you want to put two houses, go ahead. If you want to go side to side, go ahead. I mean, it was very relaxed to promote more housing. I was just going to check the zoning administrator to see where they are on it, but I got called on. That's okay. So I'm curious as to where it went, what happened, because I thought that was really drastic, kind of like we just need housing. Somehow we need to spur housing. I do agree, though. I think it was the first testifier or somebody testified. The key to housing are the developers. We can help change the laws and do what we need here, but the person that's going to invest, that's going to put the risk, the money in to do this, we need more of those. We have to make it more appealable to those folks that are willing to invest in that. As we found out earlier this week, rent isn't always paid on time. And that is a risk if you're a business developer. I mean, how many months can you hold How many months can you wait till someone pays you? So there's a lot of risk in this housing business. Hopefully this will help get the ball rolling. But there are a lot of things. This isn't the panacea. This is not the one size fits all, but it's going to start. So
thank you, Representative.
That was the question. Thank you.
Anything there, Coach Rago? Representative Buck.
Dame, Chair and Chair Igo, Representative Kraft. This is a whole new field for me. I've been saying that a lot, it seems like. My experience with developing would be on tribal lands, which is different than here. I did get a call from Woodbury, the city of Woodbury, which is one of the cities that I represent, and they had some concerns. While generally they support the bill, they did have some concerns. Two that stood out to me, and I just want to understand, because I do want to support this bill, because I believe housing is crazy. Coming from a state that I grew up in where, of course, conditions were totally different, but coming from what I grew up with to here, it's so much more expensive here than a lot of places. So I want to do what we can to help people be able to afford homes. I think it's great pride for people to be able to do that. The two areas that stood out to me, and again, I may be getting them wrong, the 1/8 minimum lot size. Cities like Woodbury work on a comprehensive plan through the Met Council. I believe that current one is through 2040, if I remember correctly. They are currently building a water filtration facility or water treatment facility because of the PFAS we now have in the Woodbury area. They have built that based off of their 2040 prediction, the comprehensive plan prediction. Reducing the minimum size would make that facility not go out to 2050, which is what they had projected. My concern with that is that will increase the cost to redo or make the facility work past 2050 or before 2050. That won't go out to 2050. My concern is with that higher cost, they're going to pass that off in property taxes. While I don't live on the Washington County side of my district, I live on the Ramsey County side of my district. I've lived there for 3 years. My property taxes have gone up $3,000, $1,000 each year. It's getting to the point where I may not be able to afford it if the property taxes keep going up. So passing off more money to taxpayers to have to pay property tax is concerning to me. The other concern that I have that, again, may be misunderstanding, but I want to learn. I want to know. I want to make the best decision for the city or for the residents of this state and my district. But the other concern is, let me find it, the environmental side of things. I'm just going to read what they sent me because it's just easier. Woodbury utilizes the conditional use permit process to evaluate impacts on the natural environment and public infrastructure for multiple family projects. This process has allowed the city to preserve forested lands and natural resources. Moving to permitted use for these developments significantly decreases the city's ability to protect the environment. And protecting the environment on top of protecting our human relatives is very important to me as well. And that was one thing that I really loved about the area I moved to. There is a lot of green space, there's a lot of nature, and that was important to me. So I just want to make sure that those two concerns specifically are addressed. But I'm very thankful for your willingness to continue to work with everybody, all the stakeholders on this, because I think it's an important issue that we have to get done sooner than later. So, Padami Ayepi, thank you.
Coach Rago or Representative Kraft?
Yeah, I'll start on this one. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Buck. So first, the offer is out to meet with Woodbury to get into to specific detail on these kind of things. In general, what I hear, though, is worried about water treatment plants and sizing of that. I would say that that is, my understanding, is typically dependent on the number of people one is serving. And we're not saying you're going to serve more or less. In fact, with a more minimum lot size, you may be serving the same number of people in a smaller amount of land. So theoretically, your infrastructure costs will be less because they don't have to go as far. So that's just one thought for you. If there is a situation where there's an environmental issue by adding some density, and also with your multifamily projects, if it's a multifamily in an environmentally sensitive area, the subdivision 11 really is that, hey, look, if there is an environmental issue here that's going to, where the infrastructure prevents it from supporting something that's mentioned in the bill, then you don't have to do it. So I think from an environmental perspective, that's what I would say to address what you've raised.
And I'll just add one thing too, because property taxes were mentioned. One of the best ways to bring down property taxes is have more people living in your community helping pay property taxes.
Representative Buck, did you have any follow-up? Right, thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to everyone who's worked on this. I've been proud to work on this as well, and I've been pushing this for a lot of years. And I'm going to share the story that you all know I'm going to share, but there's a corollary and an update to it. So for those that have not heard my North Star story, parent of six kids, one of them serves in the U.S. Navy and was deployed somewhere and looked up at the stars and said, like any good sailor, knows how to navigate back home based on the North Star, and has sent me a number of messages over the years. Dad, I always know that I can come back to our home in Waconia if things really get bad. Well, Sailor is now married to another sailor, and they are talking grandkids. And I will tell you, Minnesota, you missed the boat. You were too late. You've delayed it too long. You've drug your feet, and you've made it so that now Mrs. Nash, my Mrs. Nash, is pretty crabby about the whole thing, because my sailor is not going to move to Minnesota. And you ask why? Because the opponents to this over time have made it so that Sailor Nash cannot live here in the state of Minnesota, because he says, Dad, I can't afford it. It's taken too long, and the naysayers have clutched their pearls and wrung their hands and have made it such that I can't afford to move home, when my wife desperately wants to be near grandbaby. Whenever that day happens, you blew it, Minnesota. And now I've got a kid who's going to move somewhere else. But this bill can actually change that trajectory for other families who are looking at grandkids or who are looking at graduating college and getting a decent job but not being able to fully afford their first home in the state of their choosing. So today we're talking about a bill that will do just that. We're talking about planting a flag so that people who would like to live in Minnesota, and after the cold that we had this winter, why, we still aren't really sure, but they want to. We have let this drag on for too long, so that now my kid is going to live a fairly long day's drive away for grandma to not be able to go see grandbaby whenever that happens. So I hope that we can get this done so that I don't have to tell the other kids that Minnesota blew it for them too. So thank you to everyone who has worked on this. I've been very proud to be a part of this for years. This is an opportunity where we've worked with stakeholders, we have worked with concerned citizens, we've worked with concerned mayors, we've worked with people from around the state in all sort of different constituencies. And now we have something that not everybody's either thrilled with, and that people walk away thinking, oh, we could have gone a little bit longer, but this is what we've got, and this is good. And I hope for the other five Nash kids that there's a possibility to move back to their North Star state, because housing is for everybody, and they should have the ability to navigate their way home.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Myers.
First, let me say thank you to Chair Igo, Chair Howard, as well as Representative Kraft. I know the countless hours you guys have put into this. Chair Igo was recently married, and he's probably spending more time on this than his wife, which he's, I appreciate that. And this bill's come a long way. And I know one thing that we all have in common in this room, and even the people that testified are here, is that we all want to address housing. I think maybe we all have a little different idea. like I don't know if it was Chair Igo or Chair Howard said, I also thought this was going to be coming to the committee for a vote. So I did offer a write-up, a few amendments. I've offered some of these amendments in the past. Anything new that this committee hasn't seen, but I'm listening to the feedback that I get from my constituents, my cities, the organizations that I represent. And some of those, population size, impacts on some of the density, effective date. I have some small cities that are really impacted with a lot of the infrastructure needs, a lot of water treatment plants. Those were brought up as well, roads, sewers. I'm hopeful that we can continue to have these conversations as they go. I know this bill has changed substantially from where it was. I think for a lot of people, it's much more palatable. And as we continue to work during this session, and anything that we pass here needs to be bipartisan, I hope we can continue that spirit and have those conversations. And as Representative Kraft said, maybe some of my cities would like to have some conversations with you guys as well. And I think that's important, and I appreciate that offer. I look forward to continue working on this.
Representative Johnson. Co-Chair Igo or Representative Kraft?
If you're referring to one of the menu options, yes, that is one of the things on there is having no parking minimums, yes, that they are able to choose from.
So, thank you. I'm concerned a little bit, and the city's concerned about that too, is that when homes are, I'm seeing 4 or 5 cars in front of the home. Many times you have 3 kids, and each one of the kids have a car. My kids each had a car, I had a car, my wife had a car. And so my concern is if you start taking away those minimum parking, this would any kind of a minimum, where are those cars supposed to park? And the concern is they're parked in the road. So that you have to plow. If you don't plow around there, if you have to try and get around them, then all of a sudden you create issues with fire trucks getting through. Because the roads already are getting narrower and narrower in our community. And the fire trucks barely fit down there as it is. And all of a sudden you start putting cars on each side, you are going to start. In fact, if you look at my community and have an HOA, every car has to be in a parking spot, inside the garage where you get in trouble. My concern is going to no minimums will create, even in townhomes, places will put cars out where they should be, and you get a snowstorm and the plows can't get around. So that's one of the concerns that I have with having those minimum parking.
Co-Chair Igo?
I'll just add that that's why it's a menu option and not a mandate. Right? So for cities that it makes sense, for example, my city of Hibbing, which is almost 20,000 people and has small city streets, has no parking minimums. They made the decision as a city council and said it works for their city and they're going to support this to try and drive down the cost of housing. So I think that's why it's not a mandate in the bill. It's a prescriptive menu option that you can choose if you'd like to try and attain your points. Or do the
city has to choose how many menu
items. Co-Chair Igo?
Section 2, level 2 cities, say college role.
Mm-hmm.
How many menu items do they have?
Co-Chair Igo, Representative Kraft?
Sorry, Chair. 4. I'd also want to say no parking minimums, if you choose to do it, doesn't mean no parking. It just means the market can determine what's best in that situation. But level 2 city is 4.
Representative Kraft, or Igo, how many total menu items are there?
11.
11. Okay.
Sure.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And I just have, thank you. I wanted to get that answer. But I think the intentions are worthy. I'm concerned about the bill. I don't think in my mind, in my city's mind, bill does not address that in communities like Lake Elmo, water restrictions are preventing new homes from being built. That's DNR water restrictions that have been put in place because of the lawsuit having to do with White Bear Lake, so they're limited to what they can do right there. They also have a PFAS issue. Does not recognize the result that taxes, employer mandates are increasing the cost of housing. It also fails to address the labor shortage. So this bill does not guarantee that housing prices will actually go down. The only solution to the crisis is building more homes.
Co-Chair Igo, Representative Graff, anything? If not, Vice Chair Kozlowski.
Thanks, Chair Howard and members for bringing forward this bill. I'm excited to be here again, and we'll look forward to the day when we pass this off the House floor. But a combination of 2 years of hard work, I look around this room and many hands and fingerprints and kind of blood, sweat, and tears, it feels like at this point, have been in it. So thank you. You know, and I just keep coming back to the Minnesotans who keep coming back to us and telling their stories like we heard from the testifier today from northeastern Minnesota in our neck of the woods, who said, I can't afford to live and raise my family in the community that I love. And when you can't find a home in Minnesota, it's not so Minnesota nice. And so I just, there's a few highlights, you know, out of this bill for me. It's no surprise that I believe housing is a human right. And I'm proud to have brought forward the buy right and commercial housing for the multifamily that for me and for many of our communities is literal lifelines. And I'm grateful that that's included and centered in the work that we've done together. I think we've heard throughout this time kind of that apartments, you know, they're more affordable, yet we treat them as a hazard. And I would be remiss if I didn't talk a bit about the history of why that is and why duplexes and apartments where predominantly people of color, folks who are working class people lived. And so when redlining was outlawed, you know, the rules change and cities and government changed those rules. And although the language of race and class was neutral, we certainly know the outcomes weren't and that that's having an impact on us all. But in terms of this bill, you know, kudos to everybody with the menu of accordion options. We heard really loud and clear from local government partners across the state, especially out in greater Minnesota, that we need more menu of options, choice, flexibility. And I want to highlight the that it takes effect for in the commercial multifamily portion for cities that have a population of 5,000 or over. That's really from listening to community. This bill front loads community input. We heard from some cities that were doing 2 and 3 public meetings to some cities who had 10, 11, and 12 public meetings. So this isn't a solve all. It's necessary, but not sufficient. We know we're still gonna need subsidy and funding and to continue to fight for especially affordable housing. And the last thing I'll note is just that while supply will help, it won't equalize rent and tackle the affordability gap. You know, our income growth in terms of a worker who is making minimum wage in Minnesota has to work 2.1 to 2.5 jobs and has to work 80 hours a week just to afford a one-bedroom home at $22 an hour. And so this is a really strong start to shrinking the gap that we have with our housing supply, to shrinking the gap on rent, to shrinking our climate footprint and our daily footprint, but to unleashing our tax base. To your point, this is gonna bring in greater tax base to help all of our communities to push our economy forward. And I hope that it's one big giant step forward into guaranteed homes for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll offer just a couple, since we're running short on time, I'll try to be brief so I have time to go to the authors. For a final statement, but I first wanted to start with a few thank yous. One to the incredible coalition that has worked on this bill for a number of years, and want to again call out how unique it is to have folks in labor, business, grassroots organizations with progressive, grassroots conservative organizations, climate focused organizations, affordable housing
providers, for-profit housing providers. It really runs the gamut. I haven't seen a coalition like this. And the part of the coalition that continues to grow is regular Minnesotans. That's where we keep hearing more and more people, and the call keeps growing for us to do something about this core issue for every Minnesotan and affordability. And I also want to thank the host of members that have their fingerprints on this, Representative Nash, Representative Kozlowski, especially on the multifamily front, Representative Ray Rauer, and Representative Kraft, Co-Chair Igo, to name a few. Again, it's a diverse interest of members from all across the state from different parties saying, we need to address this issue for all Minnesotans. And then I also want to thank all of the cities and their organizations that were here and testified today. As is referenced, we've spent a lot of quality time together, especially over the last 6 to 9 months. And the delete all amendment we discussed is such a stronger bill because of that partnership and collaboration and tension, but partnership, collaboration, and tension that has produced a stronger bill. And I think everybody around here is committed to continuing those conversations as we work through this process together. And it was raised a couple times that folks have a shared goal. And I think there is a shared goal that folks in this room have for us to find a way to make home a reality for more Minnesotans. And so we're in a better place because of that collaboration, and it'll continue. Just a few policy notes that I think are really important to underscore and why this bill is different and why this year is different for us to ultimately pass this important bill. One, you know, from the start, one of the core criticisms is we were doing one-size-fits-all mandates when every city is a unique animal trying to address unique needs. And really, this is now the exact opposite of one-size-fits-all. It's kind of like do it your own way. Every city has the opportunity to make this bill work in the way that best fits their community. And as a result, it'll look different in every community. And I think that's a key feature that's come after all of this feedback. The second part I wanted to raise from a policy is just to be clear on affordability. I do think that that's the core challenge in housing that we're all experiencing, is that it's just too dang expensive to build a home or to either to rent or to own. And there's multiple solutions we need, but this is a key bill to do that by building supply and to unleash not just nonprofit developers, but for-profit development. And I want to talk about a key way that market rate housing delivers affordability in a multiplier effect way. When you build a market rate home, someone is moving out of their maybe existing affordable home to live, to go buy that home. And then maybe there is someone who's renting a market rate apartment that is now moving into that affordable NOAA home. And then there's a low income renter that's then moving into that market rate home. And there's even more change. So with every new home you build, you are creating multiplier effect of people being able to move into that next a home that fits their dream. And there's research that backs this up. It's called the filtering effect. And for every, the Minneapolis Federal Reserve did a study that said for every 100 units of homes you build, not only are you creating those 100 units of homes, you're creating 70 new, more affordable opportunities for home. And so that's why this is at the central crux of how we address our affordability. We need to do more. It is just a fact that this bill will create more affordable home options across the state. And then the last thing I'll say, I said I was going to be short, but I haven't been. We can't wait another year. We can't wait another year. We've been at this for 3 years. Every year the problem gets worse. Last year we heard presentations that the average age of a homeowner was 38. This year it's 40. What's it going to be next year? How many hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans will be priced out by inaction one more year? How many more reps of Nash kids are not going to be able to find their way home? For folks that are tired of Representative Nash's North Star speech, that's another reason we passed this. It was a very good speech, Representative. But this is the year. We have done this work. We have more work to do, but because of the hard work of so many people in this room, I am confident that this is the year we get this across and in a big way, in a way that all of us can feel good about. So with that, I'll get off my soapbox and let Representative Igo and Representative Kraft have the final word.
Chair Howard, great job. It's time.
The best things in life are the hardest things to do. And this is one of those things, and we're going to get there. Thanks, members.
Thank you, members. Thank you, everybody here. With that, we're adjourned.